Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings. This is the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Christians for Liberty Network. My name is Cody Cook, and my guest is Ross Benesch. Ross is an author and a journalist who's written for a number of high-profile publications, including Esquire, The Wall Street Journal, and Rolling Stone. I could list a lot more, but I was trying to keep it short. His penultimate book, Rural Rebellion, was about how Nebraska became a Republican stronghold, but his books before that were about, to put it delicately, since we're a family podcast, making whoopee. That's a reference from the 70s, but we're going to be talking about the 1990s. His most recent book is 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. So that's the topic for today. So before I ask you any other questions, give me the elevator pitch for the book so folks kind of know what we're getting into when they start.
Yeah, it's just the gist is that the trashiest entertainment from the 90s shapes our world in strange and unpredictable ways. So, you know, I'm looking at like Jerry Springer, pro wrestling, Insane Clown Posse, Beanie Babies, seeing what that type of pop culture has to say about our current times.
Love it. Okay. Good. Concise. Well, so one of my favorite lines of the book and one that I think sums it up pretty well is this one. Jerry Springer metastasized into our culture. So what's the connection between Jerry Springer show in particular, and our culture today?
Well, Jerry Springer really showed how shock and sensation are really powerful. You know, as long as you keep people's attention, you can do a lot with that, even if you have no substance to offer beyond that. So, you know, the Jerry Springer show, it was just like every episode was just more outrageous than the one before. You know, you'd have pregnant strippers, you'd have adults pretending to be babies in diapers, a man marries his horse. I mean, it was just, you know, absolute chaos. And in all that chaos, he really showed people liked the conflict. They liked the insanity, and everything he did was taken to reality TV. And now, you know, reality TV is like in Congress and in the White House. So I think you could trace back a lot of the combative style of politics we have right now back to the Jerry Springer show.
Yeah, I think it would be actually better in a way if after Trump did the, you know, the whole they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats thing, he ended with a final thought that was kind of, you know, positive and uplifting.
Well, that's what was always funny about the Jerry Springer show is he would have the most just insane premise for like 45 minutes and then come back with like, now I'm going to lecture you for 5 minutes about why society is bad and why we should do things to help each other.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I listened to, he briefly had a show on Air America, which was like a short-lived progressive talk radio, company. And I remember somebody asked him about, like, you know, what's the connection between what you've been doing and this kind of, you know, progressive moralizing or whatever. And I think he said something that was sort of very populist, that, you know, he was like, you know, the people who I have on my show, they're, you know, they're the real America. And you know, the political situation, you know, hurts them, and we need to build a better world for those people. That was an interesting response. But
yeah, he kind of recycled that response over time. He in his movie Ringmaster, which is loosely based on his autobiography, he basically gives that response playing a fictional character of himself, where someone's dogging the Springer show, and he says, you know, this is America, and if you don't like it, turn the channel. And This is the people that are not heard. And, you know, he's preaching to the choir, of course, because it's on the Jerry Springer show that he's saying this.
Yeah, well, and you say Ringmaster, it makes me think of circuses, which of course makes me think of the Insane Clown Posse, which we'll be getting to a little bit later. But so in the book, you talk a little bit about this, the kind of low versus high culture thing. And as I think about that today, I really see it in this what I would almost argue is like the new kind of political divide, which is not so much right and left. It's kind of elitist versus populist. And I mean, do you feel like that's kind of a carryover of the kind of low versus high culture, that you have these people, maybe the kind of the left and the never Trumpers, who still sort of had this sense of what politics was supposed to be, that it was you know, something sort of respectable. And then you had this sort of populist emphasis that was, you know, less about experts and more about kind of hitting people, you know, kind of where they were in you know, middle America. Is that kind of is there a carryover there, do you think?
Well, the low versus high divide, I mean, that goes back, centuries even. And it definitely was rooted in elitism, even actually rooted in some pseudoscience with low brow and high brow coming from, what's the name of that pseudoscience that's like based on skull types and
phrenology?
Phrenology, yeah. A lot of the terminology comes from phrenology, and that, you know, persisted for a long time. Like, you know, theater would be highbrow, you know, art museums would be highbrow, lowbrow would be you know, television initially, or even you know, the novel or like dime novels when they came out. But what's considered lowbrow changes over time. But in the 90s, what I found interesting was there was a kind of a dissolve of, you know, the things that were low culture were definitely still mocked and dismissed, but they had really overtaken everything. They were the most popular entertainment formats, and they had become the most influential, and there weren't rules guiding them like there had been in the past due to a lot of media deregulations.
I mean, do you feel like, though, I mean, when I think about low versus highbrow, I understand what you mean when you say it's subjective, but there does seem to be something about kind of the low brow having to do with like the lowest common denominator, that somebody, you know, might go to an opera and then come home and you know, watch Jerry Springer, and they could kind of do both. They could sort of slum it.
Whereas, or they could go to the Jerry Springer opera.
But like going the opposite direction seems more difficult, right? Like somebody who would maybe sort of identify as lowbrow would maybe have a harder time appreciating highbrow or you know, high art. Whereas somebody who maybe is in the high art world could sort of still, I don't know, enjoy, you know, some of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say like a lot of the elitist cultured people I've gotten to know in New York still watch reality TV, but the people I grew up in rural Nebraska, you know, I don't think they would care to go to an art museum like my friends that I grew up with. So I do think a lot of the you know, elitists are more interested in the low than common folk are interested in the high. But what low culture often has going for it is that it's cheap. It's cheap to access. It's cheap to produce. You know, you don't gotta pay much money, if any, to consume it.
Yeah. That's a good point. I was going to say, you know, sometimes in film, maybe it's the opposite, right? Where the highbrow movie is the low budget movie and the lowbrow movie is the high budget movie.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Cause it's made by like an independent, and it's like, yeah, art, like Anora, that would probably be a highbrow movie. Right. And
yeah. Well, so, I mean, you seem to have an affection yourself for what might be called low culture, you know, wrestling, video games, Insane Clown Posse. So when you say that, you know, low culture has invaded high culture and politics, do you see this as a good thing or a bad thing? Because, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, that when I talk about those people who could go home and watch reality TV after seeing the opera, I think the reason they can do that is it's like, it has its place, right? It's like, okay, well, this is kind of, I sort of acknowledge that this is junky and I'm sort of enjoying it. It's like, in Amusing Ourselves to Death, Neil Postman sort of talks about that. Like, you know, he says, you know, TV is fine if we understand that it's junk food, but if once we start to think that it's, you know, sort of, you know, high media, then we get into trouble. And maybe that's kind of what's like, maybe so scary about Trump is for these sort of elites is that when they sort of saw him as a joke, it was easy because they could just laugh at it. And it was like Jerry Springer or something. But then once they realize like this is invading the world of, you know, higher level politics and foreign policy and stuff like that, that becomes sort of frightening for them. But maybe not for the folks in the low culture. So, I mean, when you think about low culture and how it affected you growing up and how, you know, you really enjoyed it and I enjoyed some of that stuff myself. I mean, do you think is there a good side to the fact that low culture has become all culture in a way?
Yeah. So I do like this stuff. I wouldn't have spent this much time researching it if I didn't enjoy it. But I guess one of the good things I feel is there's less pretense when, you know, something trashy rises to the top, when we're not caring so much about respectability and just putting out lowest common denominator stuff. You know, it can be democratizing. A lot of people like this stuff. But the issue is what makes good entertainment doesn't translate to helpful policy. So, you know, I'm all for brashness and, you know, even a little bit of ridiculousness. But if the underlying policies are regressive, then that doesn't really do much good for most people. So that's where I find the issue right now with this administration. But you know, if they're doing things that I felt were more helpful, I wouldn't you know, care that they push down the door of respectability and want to make things styled like Jerry Springer. I'd watch it. So over half the country apparently.
Yeah. Well, I think there is something. You know, I've maybe picked on low culture a little bit, but I think there's something that in the low culture critique of high culture, that there's a kind of hypocrisy, that, you know, folks in high culture are not necessarily better, but there's kind of an air of sophistication. And so I think, you know, some people in kind of MAGA world have said, well, you know, you guys were so upset about mean tweets, but, you know, you were okay with George W. Bush invading Afghanistan and Iraq on false pretenses. And I mean, I resonate with that critique. I think there's something to that. I don't know. I'd be interested maybe to kind of hear what you think about that. I mean, I think of that music video for Spice Girls Wannabe, where it's that kind of the trope of they sort of show up at the sort of the high class restaurant and uh-huh. everybody's sort of really stuffy and kind of the do you have any Grey Poupon type people. And, you know, the Spice Girls show up and they bring a little excitement and kind of low culture, you know, pop culture to it, right? I mean, is that what MAGA thinks maybe Trump is doing to politics, is kind of just opening up the curtain so we can see the hypocrisy? And
well, you know, I think people generally like someone who is willing to stretch for rules, sometimes break them, who will even do things offensive in an era where politeness may be policed too much or forced too much. So you know, there's this transgressive thing that he does that is very much like the low culture performers I loved in the 90s. And I liked a lot of them because of that. And, you know, the press has a hard time understanding why that's appealing to people. Like if you go back in the 90s and you see how pro wrestling's criticized and written about, and even current documentaries about some of the stuff, whether it's pro wrestling or Woodstock 99, it's just all condemned. It's all considered racist, sexist, whatever it is. And there's no understanding why anyone actually liked this stuff to begin with, even though tens of millions of people do. I think some of that would apply to Trump. When he does something that's like bombastic, he's not driving away the people that like him. They like him because he's doing that. It's like pro wrestling in the 90s. I wasn't like offended that they were pretending to castrate a guy with a samurai sword. That actually drove me to watch it. I wanted to see what next crazy thing they would do. I would say that there should be a difference in your criteria for entertainers compared to your criteria for politicians. But the divide between those they're one and the same at this point.
Yeah, well, and you know, you point out in the book that a lot of the kind of high profile entertainment around the 1999, which is the title of the book, was often targeted toward young men, that they sort of felt like that was a good demographic to take advantage of. And so there was kind of a crudeness and irreverence there, you know, Howard Stern and Tom Green. And you know, maybe there's a connection there with Trump, that kind of, you know, sort of crudeness that what some would call maybe toxic masculinity. You know, when you know, Trump met, you know, Zelensky earlier this year and saying, my bum is on the Zelensky, my bum is on the Zelensky, like Tom Green did. That was kind of like that. Well, you know, I never was super interested in reality TV. But, you know, that's, of course, where Trump gets his start, right? You know, so I have friends and family who are really anti-MAGA now, but they watched The Apprentice every week. And there was something about just that transition that they couldn't really bear. And so, you know, at the time, I remember sort of, you know, scoffing because I'm a little bit of a snob myself. Like, oh, why are you guys watching this crap or whatever? And so, you know, they can't imagine now how that guy became president. And so the sort of smug elitist part of me kind of wants to say, you know, you did this. You loved it. You're why he's where he is today. But then I also recognize, you know, like I said, like what Neil Postman said, that there is that maybe distinction that we should be keeping in mind. And I think I also acknowledge in my own self that I'm not, maybe a little bit of hypocrisy there, because, you know, I can also, you know, watch a John Waters movie and enjoy it. and so, you know, maybe the problem isn't so much that low culture is enjoyed, but that too many of us has failed to distinguish between what makes good trash TV and what makes for good political philosophy, as you've kind of mentioned. I mean, do you think we can enjoy low culture without Jerry Springer metastasizing into the culture at large? Or do you think we almost sort of have a moral obligation to raise, you know, our cultural values a little bit and our tastes in order to avoid, you know, like you said, that metastasizing into the culture?
No, I don't think we have to raise our standards for entertainment. And I'd be skeptical of, like, anyone who says, like, this is what you should be watching and what you should not be watching. You know, someone coming in with those, like, type of attitude, I'd be very skeptical of what they have to say. But I believe that you can enjoy this stuff without having it guide national politics. You know, even in the 90s, you know, this stuff was super popular, but there was still, like, more of a divide between how policy was put into place and how our entertainment industry functioned. And we're talking about Trump a lot, but, you know, the book, there's a lot more beyond just that. You know, there's other moral panics that have set in. There's other economic things that have taken on aspects of low culture, such as, like, the collectible fads with NFTs. But I just don't think that one has to lead to the other. Like, just because, you know, Jerry Springer and online porn and the Insane Clown Posse and South Park and all these things got popular, that didn't have to contribute to our current situation. We could view distinctions between things that we enjoy consuming and the types of leaders and policies we want to vote for. But as the divide between politics and entertainment just continues to dissolve, it's harder to do that right now, for sure.
Well, I mean, I think about, there was a major, well, maybe not major, but a political figure in the 1990s, a guy named James Traficant, who was kind of a populist left-wing figure who, you know, was also kind of very patriotic and sort of appealed to that kind of sense of, you know, patriotism. And, you know, he, even though he was a politician, he wasn't really treated as a serious political figure. He was somebody that was kind of laughed at. And, you know, Springer and Trump, and not all these questions are about Trump, but were also figures who tried to get into politics, you know, after you know, being these sort of populist or sort of popular culture figures. And they were kind of laughed at, you know, people forget that, or don't remember, don't know that, you know, Trump ran for president in 2000. And then he ran again in 2016. And in 2000, he was laughed at. And that was apparently the right response, right? The media sort of treated him as a joke. And that seemed totally reasonable. But in 2016, they treated him as a joke and they were way off because he became president, you know? And so, I mean, maybe kind of part of this sort of question of, you know, is it sort of inevitable as pop culture invades everything that we would sort of go in this direction? You know, like you said, that we didn't do it then, but maybe we were paving the way for it. Maybe there was this sort of, you know, as we sort of lowered everyone's expectations, we kind of got here. So, I mean, why were they right? Why was the media right to treat Trump as a joke in 2000, but not in 2016? What do you think changed between in those 16 years?
So, you know, 25 years ago, the turn of the century, the political parties were much more powerful than they are now. Like the gatekeeping apparatus of becoming a candidate that would emerge out of a primary was much stronger than it is now. So Springer was thinking about running for Senate in Ohio and basically was pushed out of the race before it even started. They gave him no path to winning that nomination. He pulled out. Jack Kevorkian, I can't think of the guy's name, but Jack Kevorkian's lawyer won the Democratic primary for governor of Michigan, and he got trounced in the general election, but he faced a lot of opposition from his own party. He was kind of like one of these, like, you know, fringe entertainer type figures. Of course, Trump, announced in 1999 he was going to run in the 2000 election of the Reform Party. Those guys all had a much tougher path to gain a foothold in their party than they would have now. You know, both parties now are kind of weak. The Republican Party is the Trump Party, and the Democrats have no really central leadership. And a more fringe candidate can emerge now in a way I think was harder back then. And you also have more direct access to the people with social media and just, you know, online media in general. You don't have to rely on like 60 Minutes or Meet the Press or, you know, whatever you would have been doing in the late 90s. Now, like, your campaign, your media strategy is going to be completely different, and more, you can be more independent than you were then.
Yeah. So it's not so much the pop culture's fault. It's more just kind of circumstances around politics and technology, you think?
I think that's a big part of it, but people have, pop culture and politics have obviously melded more aggressively. So, I don't think it's an either or. It's probably all the above to varying degrees contributing.
Well, so, and I think, you know, I look back a little bit and it seems that as long as they've been making, you know, popular entertainment, at the very least, you know, movies, we'll say, these kind of concerns have been raised. I think about the 1976 movie Network, and it's this kind of idea where they're talking about sort of a sensationalistic, you know, news and this kind of proto-reality TV situation. So there's one memorable plot point where they're creating a live weekly TV show that follows around a group of radical black nationalist terrorists. And like, that feels, you know, very 90s or 2000s, right? But it's,
yeah.
But they were sort of maybe seeing it coming in a way. Or there was another movie even earlier, 1957, A Face in the Crowd, where you have this kind of crude populist, you know, variety show host, and he's propelled into the political sphere. And he sort of says, you know, these people, you know, watch me on TV, they hear me on the radio, they're going to vote for me, right? And so it seems like this has been maybe a concern for a long time. I mean, do you feel like maybe the writing was already kind of on the wall as we sort of were developing more popular forms of media, or were they exaggerating then and now it's true?
Well, and it's not even just in movies. You could go back 100 years and Sinclair Lewis had the book It Can't Happen Here,
right?
And has a lot of the same themes. He's writing at a time of extreme fascism in Europe, so that's informing what he's coming in with. But these concerns have been there. You mentioned Neil Postman a few times. I mean, I'd say he has, you know, a lot of these concerns. He's probably the prophet of some of these concerns. But I don't also believe that low culture has to be a bad thing if it's bleeding into broader society. You know, we're going to talk about the Juggalos. Their outsider status and their appeal to that is something that's used very widely by religious groups, by political groups. And I don't think that's all bad, because people tend to find a belonging community being around others who feel that they're outcasts.
You kind of mentioned this earlier, but one feature of the book is these kind of moralizing crusades against low culture. And, you know, in the 90s, the left mostly criticized video games, and the religious right went after, you know, action movies and sleazy daytime talk shows. And, you know, things have changed. So, you know, people I know who, you know, clutch their pearls when talking about the Jerry Springer show and Bill Clinton's adultery in the White House, voted for Trump. They voted for the Jerry Springer show into the White House,
yeah.
You know, one, two, three times, or at least tried to do it three times.
And Jerry Springer himself said that that was his show brought into the White House. So that's from the horse's mouth.
It's funny. Well, so, I think we kind of addressed this earlier, but maybe I'll ask kind of a more pointed way. is it a neutral thing for crudeness and demagoguery to be the primary language of our discourse? I mean, were we better off when we were kind of more moralizing, we were concerned about respectability, or should we be glad that the facade of respectability came down? What are the dangers of both approaches or both issues, both circumstances?
You know, like being a fan of low culture, I'm down for the facade coming down. But the problem is I know I've hammered this a few points. Trump doesn't have any great policies or great ideas that are actually going to help the working class. So, if he's crude, so be it. But what do you have beyond just being funny and owning the libs? Like what actual thing are you doing that's going to help them? Because like the tariffs definitely aren't doing that. If anything, they're driving up inflation, making the economy harder to run. So we have the facade down, but we are also like being run like a game show rather than like a someone trying to put in laws that are going to have a real effect on people's lives. It's almost like just one-upsmanship, who can own their enemy the hardest or target the person who they believe is their enemy. Like some of these lawsuits he has with various media organizations.
I feel like there was kind of always this idea that, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, would argue on the news or whatever, but then they would go out and get a beer together. There was always this kind of, cavorting across political party lines. And you talk about this kind of pro wrestling phenomenon called kayfabe. And so there was a sort of accusation that was sort of happening across parties. And it seems like maybe it's happening now within maybe party, within the Republican Party. Kind of a Donald Trump and Ted Cruz kind of a relationship. Do they hate each other? Do they love each other? Is it for show? What's going on there? So, and that's the kayfabe phenomenon. So, can you talk about that a little bit and how you think it's maybe been increasingly adopted in politics?
Yeah. So kayfabe is just the, suspending your suspending disbelief to go along with the storyline. So, if I see The Ultimate Warrior is being presented as being a man from parts unknown, I'm not going to sit there and say, no, he's not. He's just this freak from Venice Beach. You go along with it. You buy into the lie because that's what the spectacle is about. You want to enjoy the show. So kayfabe, what I see in society is like anytime organization or a political group is pushing some sort of BS and people just kind of go along with it because it's easier to do so and it benefits them down the road. It's like a pro wrestling script brought to life. Now, I mentioned in the book because wrestling was most popular in the 90s, more popular than it is now. So it helped prime people for this example of kayfabe. And just to give you a few examples, when Alex Jones was in a custody battle, he said that everything on his show was a facade and that he was playing a character, even though when he's on his show, he very much presents it as like, no, I really believe these things and so should you. He presents a different tactic in court than he does on his show. He's saying these are two separate things. That's very much like a pro wrestling thing. It would be a very strange concept to think of that if we didn't have the popularization of pro wrestling that we have. So I just have seen that sort of thing played out often recently where you can't even hardly believe what someone is telling you because it's part of their shtick.
Well, and maybe this isn't as much of a shtick thing, but I mean, at this point, even, folks on the left are kind of admitting that Biden was not really kind of who he said he was, who his handlers were presenting him as. And he was really sharp and he kind of knew what was going on.
His Weekend at Bernie's over there.
Right. And I mean, is that kind of an example of kayfabe that people sort of believe that everything's okay and they say, oh, yeah, well, this is just a Republican talking point. These are cheap fakes. I mean, is that kayfabe or is kayfabe kind of a... a cognitive dissonance or what is, how does that sort of...
I would say there was some kayfabe there because the Democratic spokespeople who, you know, when you'd see those debates and he's like looking around like he's got dementia, but they would tell you everything is fine. They're trying to get people to buy it, to suspend their disbelief, because, you know, just go along with it. Ultimately, you want the Biden presidency because that's what's good for the people who are pushing that narrative. And the fact that so many people went along with it for so long, like Jake Trapper, you know, acting outraged now that, oh, this isn't how we were presented. I mean, you didn't need to have inside access to know that he was an old man on the cognitive decline. So, yeah, I would say there's some kayfabe with that. The way CNN like portrays Biden's age now compared to how they portrayed it like early 2024 when that campaign was like really in the thick of it. There's definitely some kayfabe there in presenting fakery as truth.
It's sort of like the idea that Jay Leno could actually wrestle with the NWO, right? in the world championship wrestling.
Yeah, yeah. 1998 Road Wild pay-per-view. I remember that one fondly.
Yeah, I wasn't super big into wrestling, but for whatever reason, I watched that one. And it sounds ridiculous now that I would think it was possible that Jay Leno could, you know, wrestle with Hulk Hogan. But later in the book, you explore the idea of pop culture as a replacement for religion, which I think is a really interesting concept. We're kind of in this, you know, supposedly post-religious age, but we still have these, God-shaped holes, so to speak. I would argue that this could maybe be reworked as the real center of your thesis. I picked on, you know, Trump a lot, but Trump has been successful at making himself a real cultural touchstone. So it's kind of hard to ignore him in this conversation, I think. So I'll pick on him just a little bit more before we move on. So you talk about how the Insane Clown Posse adapted religious language and practices to create a, pun intended, cult following. And we could, you know, draw a line from there to MAGA, the outsider status of, you know, white trash juggalos, as a pretty neat parallel to the deplorable moniker being worn as a badge of honor by MAGA folks. So, Trump is certainly not the first politician to have a cult following. I think Obama, you know, had that too. But it was maybe more in the traditional sense of kind of the great man, the JFK, like, you know, sort of president, or the Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the kind of neoclassical politician who, you know, he kind of looks like he's carved in marble, and they actually do, you know, sometimes carve him in marble. I see that as, you know, arguably just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, but it's very different from the kind of the low culture view of power that, you know, Trump instantiates. You know, it's easier to imagine, you know, Trump is a butter sculpture than a marble sculpture. But, is there a sense in which, popular culture's replacement of other social glues like religion maybe points to the decay of society and maybe foretells a civilizational apocalypse. Maybe the issue isn't so much that low culture is spreading, but that it's taking the place not of high culture, but of kind of previous things that gave us meaning, a sense of kind of belonging and purpose. Is that maybe what's going on?
Yeah, you know, in the book, I mentioned how religious affiliation declined a ton since ICP's first album came out in 1992, Carnival of Carnage. And people have filled that God-shaped hole with all sorts of things, but pop culture is a big one of them. I mean, people really lose their minds worshiping celebrities right now. With the Juggalos, though, I don't know if it's civilizational decay or apocalypse or however you phrased it. You know, some of these people are really down on their luck and seem to benefit from the community that they get from this band. Now, it may look different and certainly sound different than a traditional religious group, and some of what they do is questionable. But I don't know if we can say that they're worse off for doing this than if they didn't do it at all. Because it's not to say if they didn't do it at all that they would be, obedient, God-fearing people or something. They might do something even more crazy and out there. So I view the community of Juggalos as ultimately more positive than negative. And even if it is being used as a displacement for traditional belonging.
Well, and I kind of get the sense that you may identify yourself as a Juggalo. You at least talk about going to some of the gatherings. Does it kind of fill that role for you personally?
No, it doesn't fill that role for me. I am down with the clowns, so I'm not going to deny that. But I'm not on that level. I don't have a Hatchet Man tattoo. I don't know a whole lot of other. I mean, I know some, you know, casual ICP fans, but I don't know like a ton of like real hardcore Juggalos. But I have seen that in action. But I it doesn't have that intense of a meaning for me, even though I am incredibly fascinated by them.
Well, and you know, to maybe kind of balance my self presentation as a bit of a snob. I actually really appreciated what you said about how the Insane Clown Posse's fan base imitates Christianity in another way, which is its appeal to the kind of forgotten and downtrodden as opposed to the respected and powerful. And, you know, I think about what the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said. He saw Christianity's appeal to the weak as a kind of societal decadence that turned the rightful, you know, social order upside down. And, you know, I would argue that he was fundamentally wrong about that. I don't think that those who dominate others are deserving of our honor and respect as he did.
Well, yeah, I would expect a host of a Christian podcast to be in disagreement with a God is dead guy.
Right, there you go. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, because I mean, I think God cares about the downtrodden. I think that's a really kind of strong biblical message. And I also wonder if there's a difference between saying that God is on the side of the poor, on the one hand, and on the other hand, saying that, you know, maybe we should, that some of the maybe the unhealthiest aspects of what Juggalos themselves would maybe call white trash subculture should be celebrated, that those kind of parts of poverty in the United States that are maybe perpetuated less by social injustice and more by drug addiction, family dysfunction, some of those things. And this is maybe where I'm probably an outsider, and so I may be making criticisms that are just outsider criticisms. You know, do you think that Juggalo subculture celebrates what's unhealthy about the culture of poverty, or is this just my misunderstanding as a snobbish outsider?
Well, you know, they don't really have a central thesis or like there's no how should I phrase this. Like ICP isn't, they're just trying to sell merch and records. They're not truly trying to evangelize, even though their followers have taken this cause upon themselves to band together. So I feel like a lot of this just happens with Juggalos. Like ICP isn't like intentionally pushing out like a particular message or cause the way like the Pope would. You know what I mean? Like the, where there's real intention and strategy and desire to reach people, they have these people who are interested in their group, and they just want to make stuff to sell to them. What happens after that is anyone's guess.
Well, I mean, I look back growing up in this period, and I mean, it seems to me that like you look at someone like Eminem. And Eminem was I feel like,
and he had a beef with ICP.
I think you're right about that. But they're similar in a lot of ways, right? I mean, they appeal to a similar sort of fan base, and they.
Well, yeah, they're both white rappers from Detroit.
Well, there's that, but I think also that I think there was this kind of real sense of, and I don't necessarily mean to use this as a derogatory, but kind of the idea of kind of the poor white trash person being like the. That was their sort of experience, and that was what they were talking about.
Oh yeah, that's what the whole movie 8 Mile is.
Right. And then, you know, critics on the outside sort of said, you know, well, aren't you glorifying this? And you know, Eminem talked about the sort of feelings of violence and purple pills and stuff like that. And, you know, and I think that's maybe a criticism of hip hop too, is when it became sort of transitioned into gangster rap. You know, are they just talking about this, you know, growing up this way? Are they glorifying it? And so those became these sort of moralizing questions about, is there, and I think the moralizers want to say, well, you have a perspective, you have a point of view, you have values, and you're communicating them. And I mean, that sounds kind of reasonable, but then the response is, well, on the one hand, it's just art, but also on the other hand, I'm not necessarily saying anything's good. I'm just talking about my experience, right? Or I'm just talking about something that I've seen. But I guess what I wonder is, does there, I don't know, I feel like I'm getting into some of these moralizing territories myself. I mean, you can listen to, you know, some of the early Eminem stuff and not necessarily share his values on, or what he's suggesting could be his values or the
I think most people want to like kill their wife or their mom or whatever the hell he's rapping about. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he kind of has the whole thing where like, so it's like the id, the ego, and the super ego, right? Where you sort of have, I think, is it Slim Shady is the id and Eminem is the ego and Marshall Mathers is the super ego kind of.
Yeah, I guess you could, that's the trinity of Eminem personalities.
Right. Well, that's sort of the idea is like, depending on sort of how sort of carnal or depraved or just, you know, kind of base he's being, he's like, oh, well, that's, you know, this is Marshall or this is, you know, Slim Shady or whatever. And, but I think those are the kind of questions that were being asked, like, are we, you know, glorifying some of these horrible things? And, did the moralizers have a point in being concerned about that, or is it the kind of thing that people just sort of said, well, it's entertainment, it's not shaping my values? I mean, when you talk about the ICP, it seems like it does become sort of like a value shaper, right? For some of the people who really get into it.
Well, the moralizers, they may have a point, but I would argue that they've been outvoted. The moralizers have tried to censor a lot of the stuff, whether it's video games or rap music. And the people who like it greatly outnumber those who want to restrict it. And that's just gone on through basically every media format. So, you know, the moralizers, I think, are at a disadvantage for pushing their point across on that, because that's not what most individuals seem to want.
People are voting with their dollars.
Yeah.
Well, so, now that I've dragged us into talking about the decline of Western civilization, let's segue into Pokemon.
All right.
So you write that the Pokemon gotta catch 'em all phenomenon was sort of early or young capitalist indoctrination for kids. And I mean, I like Pokemon all right, but I don't think it's that great. I wouldn't call it indoctrination into capitalism for kids. But what did Pokemon say about American culture at that time? And do you feel like it foreshadowed our current time? Some of the examples you give, you draw sort of more explicit connections to our current time. And uh-huh. You know, I mentioned Trump a lot because that's one of the connections that you do draw. But other ones, I'm not maybe as clear on the current kind of how that brought us here. So what's the connection between Pokemon and here?
Well, Pokemon is just the, you know, your wealth is, I mean, your worth is your accumulation of stuff, like gotta catch them all. I gotta be the Pokemaster. You gotta have everything. You gotta have the TV show and the movie and the video games and the merch and the mobile game and the trading card game. And it's all gotta come together. And if you want to be on top of it, you need to spend unlimited amounts of money and time around it, which, you know, I have nothing against Pokemon. I've played Red and Blue a fair amount, and Detective Pikachu was a very lovely movie.
I played Blue a couple years ago on an emulator, I think, on my phone.
Yeah, probably brought back some good memories. But you know, Pokemon is taking off at like a time when the national savings rate was like being cut in half. There's a line from Fight Club at the time. I don't remember the exact line, but Brad Pitt says something about like, you know, all these guys are working these jobs they hate so they can buy stuff that they don't even want. That's like a lot of consumerism. And I feel like Pokemon just perfects it. God bless them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is you talk about Fight Club. I mean, there's kind of a...
Which was in 1999.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Well, there's kind of a moralizing there too, right? I mean, you know, Fight Club is kind of ends up sort of being, you know, the Unabomber Manifesto, the movie. And I think it's not clear to me that the, you know, that the main character is a villain, right? I mean, so at the end, they kind of blow up the, you know, kind of blow us back into the Stone Age. I mean, and then that's maybe an improvement because now people aren't consumeristic anymore. there's a bit of a maybe kind of a moralizing aspect there too. But people are maybe in fact also voting with their dollars that on some level they want the Pokemon.
Oh yeah, right? Well, it brings a lot of joy. You know, consumerism isn't all bad. All these '90s things we've been talking about. You know, had an aspect of consumerism to them. And like, why did you watch that show or buy that video game? I mean, because you probably enjoyed it. And I don't think that's all bad. You know, if you got to catch all 151 Pokemon though and buy like two Game Boys and two cords that connect them and two cartridges of Pokemon Red to do so, that gets to be a little bit ridiculous. But overall, yeah, I don't think there's an inherent problem with consumerism. But people watch Fight Club, I've heard like criticism. I like Fight Club. I've heard criticisms of like, oh, like they're really glorifying, you know, this like toxic masculinity and all this aggression and violence. And my take when I watched the movie, I was like, that guy's life sucks. I don't want to like live in that house with those dudes. I'd rather like have all my crap in my room and be comfortable, you know?
Right.
Like nothing they're doing looks enjoyable.
Sure. Well, I mean, so when I played Pokemon, I think I probably had Blue, but I had a friend who had Red. And so what we did was we traded. And so that became a social component. I wasn't having to buy both games. I was just, Pokemon encouraged me to, you know, go over next door and hang out with my friends and trade Pokemon.
There definitely was a social aspect too, to the trading card game.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a game you would usually play, in solitary.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And what I did, I think I collected some of the cards for a while. I never got past maybe 153 once sometime after maybe Togepi, I just kind of stopped paying attention. But yeah, I mean, I think I just sort of collected them. I didn't play very much, but I liked just having them. I was with the gotta catch them all guy. You come across as maybe a bit more libertarian in your sections on adult movies and video games, and I'll set the adult movies discussion aside since we try to keep a fairly broad audience, but I will encourage listeners to get your book for its discussion of how legal battles over adult movies set precedents for free speech that we should all be thankful for. But on video games, you highlight the hysteria of the 90s over violent video games from, you know, out of touch old people who didn't play or understand them, and whose fears seem kind of ridiculous now. And I think what might surprise folks is that video games were just the latest medium to be accused of creating moral degeneracy. And so it followed in that great tradition of first printed books and then the dime novel. You know, now there's high literature, low literature. And then you kind of move into now radio plays because the sophisticated people read books, but the trashy people listen to radio plays. And now, comic books, and now movies, and then television. And so there's this kind of grand tradition of whatever the new technology is responsible for creating moral degeneracy. And then we get to video games. And so can you talk a little bit about that kind of history of moral panic and why it might still be relevant today? I mean, is there a connection between that and fears about TikTok, for example?
Yeah, sure. So with all those forms of entertainment that you mentioned, when they initially are picked on and blamed for all these crimes or societal ills, they are consumed by young people primarily at that point. When they're new, like the early adopters tend to be under 30. So those people who are like, you know, especially if they're over 50, they don't have a familiarity with it. They just see it as like the next thing that's bringing down global peace or whatever, or bringing down national security. Like there's hearings on comic books 70 years ago in Congress. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. But that medium, whether it's comic books or movies or video games, and in the 90s it was video games, it just like keeps gaining popularity. Like first it starts with kids, but then those kids grow up and they still keep, like the kids who grew up like listening to radio, they kept listening to radio when they're adults. The kids who grew up in the like 70s and 80s playing video games, well, they're playing video games like as an adult in the 90s. And then a new generation of kids come and it gains mass popularity. And by the time one of these entertainment formats, like you take video games, for example, when it gains enough popularity, it isn't the one that's picked on as much. So video games in the mid-90s, their average age, the average gamer was like early 20s. By 2010, the average gamer was about 35. So during that time, as the average age increases significantly, more adults have familiarity, you see video games blamed less than they were in the 90s. Like today, if if there's some sort of weird behavior happening with kids or there's a shooting or something like that, video games aren't the first thing that are blamed right now. They were, though, for a long time. And now today, you mentioned TikTok, the thing that the older people, and I'm starting to fall in this demographic now, as someone with kids who's got a minivan and going to be middle-aged soon, they blame the thing that they didn't grow up with that their kids are consuming. And so you see a lot of hysteria over screen time and social media. And there's a lot about social media we don't still understand. And certainly it's affected some, what's the phrase? Not self-worth, but like self-esteem of young kids. But a lot of the accusations get blown out of proportion in a way that it would be hard to back up with data, or at least the data we currently have on it. And the cycle just kind of continues to repeat. Like one day social media will be like, the average age will be like, 60 or something. And like kids of the next generation will have a whole new thing that my kids now will be freaking out about. And it doesn't seem to be an end in sight.
I think the average Facebook user is 60 at this point.
I would believe that for Facebook. Yeah.
Do you think that you think that maybe as youth culture is creeping into adult culture and adolescence is extending into the late 20s, we'll have less moral panics about youth culture?
That would be ideal, but it hasn't seemed to happen because the panic dies down until like a new format is introduced. So like if VR gets really good and like lives up to like the hype that it's been given for 20 years, people are going to lose their minds over that.
If we get into kind of Lawnmower Man territory.
Yeah, if we get into Lawnmower Man territory, exactly.
Well, I mean, Ross, we didn't get into how Beanie Babies led to cryptocurrency, but I think that's all the more reason for folks to get the book. I'll tease that for libertarian Christian listeners, because I think that there's probably a higher percentage of cryptocurrency people who listen to this podcast than many others. But we're getting kind of close to that hour mark. So I want to thank you for making time to talk with us. And I wish you the best of luck with your book. I've actually seen promotions for it on Facebook, which is kind of cool that your publisher has been promoting it.
Oh, nice.
So I encourage listeners to give it a shot. It's on paperback, Kindle, and Audible, right?
Yep.
Right. Well, where can people find you specifically?
Oh, just you can read my work at rossbenish.com. And I occasionally post on Twitter, but I've been less active and just hanging out with the kids lately.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Well, anything I didn't cover that you want to make sure is on the record?
Nice. I think you hit it all good.
Okay. Good. Well, I want to thank you, Ross, for making time to talk with us. And you mentioned rossbenish.com, and it's RossBenes. There's kind of hearing that might think there's an H there. So I just wanted to clarify that. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you, Ross, for talking with us. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the book, and I recommend everybody get a hold of it.
Hey, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello, everyone. It's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started, and because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50. And you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.